The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today on Word of Mouth, a conversation with Richard Russo, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool, which was adapted into a film starring Paul Newman as Donald Sully Sullivan, a quick-witted underachiever eking out a living in a decaying factory town. Here's Newman in a clip from the film. A young Philip Seymour Hoffman plays the local cop who pulls him over.
What's the matter now, Raymer?
Broken taillight. It's the third time. One more time, Sully, and I'm impounding this heap of yours.
Jesus Christ. Raymer, it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, if you fixed it the first time, this wouldn't happen.
23 years after that novel was published, Russo returns to North Bath in his new novel, Everybody's Fool. 10 years have passed in the fictional town, still cursed and still fixated on catching up with its booming rival, Schuyler Springs. It's Memorial Day weekend. Sully is a little richer, a little slower, and maintains his bar stool at the Iron Horse. Raymer is now chief of police and the novel's protagonist. I sat down with Richard Russo in front of a live audience at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire, to talk about his life, career, and the new novel. I asked him why he set Everybody's Fool in the late 90s instead of the present.
Well, there were some practical considerations, one of which was that Sully, and I knew I wanted him to be part of the book. I didn't know if he was going to be the main character or not, at least at the very beginning stages before I'd started to write it. But Sully was 60 in the first novel. In the movie, he was played by Paul Newman playing someone who was 60, but Sully is 60. Miss Burrell in Nobody's Fool was 80 at the time. And so in terms of who the important characters were, it seemed even 10 years later, Miss Burrell in the first book was already having many strokes, and I wanted her to be in the book, and I had to figure out a way that she could be dead and still alive. So that was one of the challenges of this book early on. I still wanted Sully to be a vital part of the book, and it seemed to me that 10 years was about right for that. I assumed that he would be slowing down at age 70. I'm slowing down at age 66, so I know he probably would be slowing down too, but I still wanted him to be robust. I still wanted him to be making his rounds between the OTB and Hattie's and the horse. I didn't want him to lose very much of his physical vitality. 10 years seemed about right because in that part of upstate New York, and I suspect that that's true in much of New Hampshire too, really all of New England, I wanted the book to take place before the digital revolution had changed everything. And so we have reference to the fact that in this book there are cell phones. But my memory of upstate New York when I was visiting at that time, actually when the film of Nobody's Fool was coming out and the years before that, I remember being in New York, and the producer on that movie was Scott Rudin, and he was one of those people who was on the cell phone all the time, even then. But I remember that the farther you got away from New York City, the farther up the thruway you went, and number one, you didn't have coverage, and number two, people who talked on cell phones were made fun of back then. Remember those halcyon days. and people, you know, there were personal computers, of course, and people were coming to terms with those and the fact that their lives were changing as a result of the revolution in electronics. But I've always felt that my towns, my upstate New York mill towns, part of their allure was that they were a little bit behind. Mm. They always have a sense of being slightly out of history. And so 1999 seemed about right. Because I think after 1999, the sad truth of it is that every place has become more like every other place. And I didn't want that to be true of my North Bath or Thomaston or Mohawk or any of those places. Maybe I just preferred them before they got completely wired.
Did you all see the movie? Who's seen the movie? The 1994 film, Nobody's Fool, from Robert Benton. Mm-hmm. Fantastic film. But for me, yeah. I now imagine Sully looking like Paul Newman, which is fortunate.
Yeah.
And for you, I wonder what that was like, because this new novel, Everybody's Fool, mm-hmm. Officer Raymer, now Chief Raymer, is really the main character right. in this one. And he was played in the film by Philip Seymour yeah. Hoffman. Did yeah. you know he had passed when you started writing this book?
I was 300 pages or so into this book when the word came of Philip's death.
So how did that change the way you were thinking about the character, or did it?
I thought it was going to change the way I thought about the character, and it turned out not changing. Philip Seymour Hoffman, this was one of his first roles in a major Hollywood picture. And it was a very small role, but, you know, as the saying goes, there are no small roles, only small actors. And he really did inhabit that that role. The few minutes that he was on screen, he was really on screen mm-hmm. in that. But we also worked together again in Empire Falls, where he had a much larger role. And I didn't actually meet him on the set of Nobody's Fool, but I did meet him for Empire Falls. And of course, there were stories, especially when news of Philip's death came, Robert Benton called me right away, or I called him, I can't remember, and exchanged a couple of wonderful Philip Seymour Hoffman stories. But when the news came that Philip had died, my first reaction was that, what am I going to have to do now? Start imagining another actor. It's not that I thought that this book would necessarily be a movie, but at this point I was still seeing Philip very much as I put Raymer through his paces and as he started doing all the wrong things, often for the right reasons, that was putting him deeper and deeper in the soup. It was always helpful to me to imagine Philip Seymour Hoffman doing that, because Philip had a kind of vulnerability to him that I think would have been so well suited to the role. So I thought, when the horrible news came, I thought, well, I need to stop thinking in terms of Philip Seymour Hoffman. But then, you know, almost immediately after that, I thought, no, that's not right, because actually he was inspiring this character. What I knew about him as a human being, and having seen him as Officer Raymer, and having worked with him again on Empire Falls, as long as he was providing the right kind of insight and inspiration for now Chief of Police Raymer, why let that go? So I took it as just axiomatic that I was going to continue down the path that I was already on and allow this great actor to inform the character, as he seemed to want to do.
Why Raymer, though? Why him as a character? He was such a minor character in the first book. And in this book, he's the chief, and he's just riddled with self-doubt.
Which he comes by rightly. Well, you know, number one, I've always liked novels or sequels in which a minor character suddenly assumes a major role. That's always, and Larry McMurtry did that, I think, in some of the sequels to Lonesome Dove. You would find the first book, of course, was about Gus and Call. And then in some of the subsequent books, one of the minor rangers would take over and become the major character. And I always liked that as a device. With great books and great writers, you often have the feeling that, okay, David Copperfield is about David Copperfield, but, you know, Dickens' cast of characters was so wonderful, and even the minor characters were so well drawn, that you always felt that he just chose it to be about David Copperfield, but it really could have been about any of these people. And that's because Dickens convinces us, rightly so, and it's one of my own particular cherished beliefs, is that there are no small lives, none, especially if it's yours. And a character like Raymer, who is a pawn on a chessboard in one book, it's a wonderful sense of revelation to see a minor character become major in its own right. It's just wonderful for readers to say, okay, he's not just an idiot. Yes, he's an idiot, but he's not just an idiot. He has the same fears and self-doubts, and he's been conditioned to be who he was. There's both nature and nurture involved. And once you get inside his head, you begin to understand why he does some of the foolish things he does. And his reasons are not that much different from ours, really. When you come, we've all been caught doing asinine things. No, I'm not going to tell you about mine, but they're all in the book. They're just given other people's names. And I think that when a minor character in a book becomes a major character in another book, it reminds us about that fundamental fact of life, which is that our tendency to think of certain people as having large lives and other people as having small lives is just fundamentally wrong. It's just not true. We all live lives that are enormous and complicated and important to us. And if you lose sense of that, you're losing a sense of the world's largeness, its complexity. And we tend to start writing people off for various reasons as being less important than other people. And I just don't believe that to be true.
I'm Virginia Prescott with a special edition of Word of Mouth today, a conversation with the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo, recorded in front of a live audience. Russo grew up in the upstate New York town of Gloversville, once the glove-making capital of the country. Like so many American manufacturing towns, the economy of Gloversville has taken a dive. Families moved away, and those who stayed limped along to make ends meet. Russo writes about that town in a memoir called Elsewhere, which is also about his relationship with his determined mother, whose family took them in after Richard's father left. The ghost of Gloversville haunts all of his fiction as well. Russo's portrayal of small town, small-mindedness is both incisive and hilarious, as are the inner lives of his characters. As readers, we are privy to their imaginations and machinations, often dramatic, sometimes grandiose, like all of us can be, and abundantly self-centered. I asked Richard Russo about how he builds those characters, from the outside or the inside first.
Well, I always know a good question because I don't know how to answer it. the building of a character, I think for most writers, is and remains deeply mysterious. Something occurs to you, and you write it down, and as you're writing it down, something else occurs to you. And often the details that occur to you are very small. It could be in the first sentence that you write down, you have an object, and then you look at the sentence that you wrote, and it occurs to you that the object is blue. And then something else occurs to you, its size or its shape or whatever. So there's a kind of accretion that happens. But I think in the deepest sense, when you're telling a story, when you're writing, you're using the front of your brain. You're trying to command the story in a certain way, but the back of your brain is busy with associations. And because it's in the back of your brain, you don't always know what the purpose of the association is. All you know is that it occurred to you. And the longer you do this, the more trust you put in things that you don't understand. So when it comes to character building, world building, what you're drawing on is in the front of your mind, but it's always being tempered by what's in the back of your mind. Now, I began this particular book in Hilldale Cemetery. And I don't remember whether that's where I began the first draft or not, but I think so. And I didn't know exactly what was going to happen there. But it seemed to me to be an appropriate place to begin this book. Now, why? Well, I'm not sure I knew why at the beginning. But as I continued to write this book, not only did it begin in a cemetery, but the actual caskets within the cemetery are moving in this. Now, why in the world would I come up with that? And I wanted them to be moving. I didn't know why. I just wanted I wanted the dead to be on the move.
Even they wanted to leave North Bath?
Yeah, maybe they wanted to get, maybe they'd had enough. I don't know, but for some reason that seemed important. And in the first book, Nobody's Fool, was very much a winter's tale that took place over a Thanksgiving and then a Christmas holiday weekend. And for some reason, this just seemed to me to be a summer's tale. And so I began it in an unseasonable heat wave at the beginning of this book, thinking that it would be, again, two weekends, until it occurred to me that I didn't really need the 4th of July, that Memorial Day was all I needed, and that the caskets were all shifting beneath the surface because the dead won't stay put. And all of these characters were haunted in some way. Raymer by his dead wife, Sully by Miss Burl, who's dead but still very much alive, still asking him that question that she'd asked him in the earlier book. Does it ever bother you that you haven't done more with the life God gave you? And all right, so my job as a writer, of course, is to make you think that I'm smart enough to figure all of that out before I've written the first word. And that's, nothing could be farther from the truth. These seemingly unrelated things, I mean, all of these details, this pattern that I just gave you about the dead on the move, about the whole thing taking place over Memorial Day weekend, being about memory, being about the conversation that the living have with the dead, that pattern that we're talking about, the character building, the world building, the building of physical detail in the book, those things occurred to me over a period of years. I mean, I've been working on this for a very long time before the figure in the carpet became clear to me, because I was doing it kind of a stitch at a time. And so, I mean, other writers may work differently. John Irving has described his process as, we're very similar writers, but his process is completely different. He maps it all out before he ever writes the first word, or so he claims. I'm not calling him a liar. I'm just saying I can't do it.
You're listening to a conversation with Richard Russo, recorded live for a special edition of Word of Mouth. Oh, so here's a question from Joyce. You know, that's one of the things about your characters. You don't seem to judge them. You seem to have a lot of compassion mm-hmm. for them. And Joyce mentions, in Nobody's Fool, each of your characters seem to see themselves as very flawed, even though the reader may not, like Miss Burl. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you have at least some feel good about themselves?
Maybe because I don't know anybody like that. I mean, really, show of hands. How many of you out there feel good about yourselves?
Depends on the day.
Okay, good. I could not be happier for you. It just seems so foreign to me. And people who are squared away are kind of difficult to write about. They're kind of like good marriages. Good marriages are much less interesting than poor marriages. And I say this, I mean, I've been married to the same woman for 43 years, and we have a wonderful marriage, and I don't want it to be an awful lot more interesting than it is. I mean, it would become more interesting if one of us had an affair or something. And our marriage is just fine, but I wouldn't want to write a book about it. And people who are happy and squared away, good, congratulations, wonderful. Saying rather snidely and resentfully, good for you. And sometimes too, we all know people who are just, they feel really good about themselves. I don't want to get into politics. But so I don't know, did I answer that question?
Well, you know, I'm going to give it a pass. I think you answered it in many ways, but I'm thinking of Sully.
Yeah.
You know, as a person who, in the book, it says, he's divorced from his wife, carrying on half-heartedly with another man's wife, estranged from his son, devoid of self-knowledge, badly crippled, and virtually unemployable, all of which he's stubbornly confused with independence.
Right.
And it's sort of the opposite of Chief Raymer, who's riddled with self-doubt. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a couple of places in this book and in your other books that we are complicit in some way with the people who want to put us down, right?
Right.
You know, sort of, there's a kind of a sad character in this book, Alice, and she was at one point married to a man who used to put her down all the time. Mm-hmm. And when someone asked, he said, I'm not telling her anything she doesn't already know.
Right.
Like, what role we play in sort of staying down?
Well, Alice is a minor character in this book, but I think she carries pretty significant symbolic importance in the book. Alice is a character based on a woman I saw probably 20 years ago. And it was in this time frame where people were seeing people in public for the first time talking on cell phones. And there was a woman that I used to see where I was living at the time who had in fact disconnected a princess phone from its cord. And she saw people talking on cell phones, and she immediately saw the purpose of cell phones to her own life because she was lonely. She had no one to talk to, obviously. I didn't get to know her, but she went everywhere with her cell phone. And I would sometimes, if we were in the same, she would appear sometimes in one of the local restaurants where I would write. And sometimes I would hear a snatch of conversation, and she would say something like Alice says in this book, "I would never treat a friend that way." And it was just absolutely, absolutely heartbreaking. But Alice, we learn during the course of this book, has been, you know, psychologically terribly mistreated. And she has that in common with now Chief of Police Raymer, who begins life with a mother who is convinced that he is going to grow up to be a criminal. It's part of the reason that he becomes a policeman. It's because his mother believes that he is going to become a thief and that he will be taken away from her, just as her father was a thief and was taken away. And so Raymer, the main character of this book, I mean, the first person who should have been building his confidence, at least a little, his own mother, seems convinced that he's never going to amount to anything. Well, this happens all too often, doesn't it, in life? Which is part of the reason that Miss Burrell is so important in this book, is that she is the one person in Raymer's youth who seems to think more of him than everybody else. Everybody else seems to be convinced that he's a fool, and so he becomes one in his own mind and in his own imagination. And it's Miss Burrell. She writes in the margin of his papers, but she's also writing in the margins of his psyche, in a way, asking him always, "Who are you? Who are you? What are you about?" And encouraging him to search for self-knowledge.
Your mother, you wrote a memoir called Elsewhere, 2012, I think-ish,
yeah.
About your leaving Gloversville,
yeah.
Which is
yeah.
North Bath in many ways. And she was determined to get out of there.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about, like, if you've ever imagined what your life would be like had you stayed in North Bath, or is that actually what you're writing?
Well, when I wrote my novel, Bridge of Sighs, when that book came out, because the structure of that book is a little bit different from my other books, and it's somewhat more ambitious in the sense that there are really three major characters in that book. But the two characters that we meet early on, Lucy, that is Lou C. Lynch, Lucy and Bobby are two boys that grow up in a town like North Bath. It's Thomaston in that novel. And Lucy is the boy who stays, grows up, lives there his entire life in this very closed environment. Bobby, his best friend, leaves, and when the novel begins, he's become this painter who's now living in Venice and has lived in most of the major capitals of Europe, and has never gone back to his hometown. And when the book came out, And evenings like this, where I was in conversation and you know, just regular readers on the road would say, "Well, all right, so who are you? Are you Lucy or are you Bobby?" And the answer to that was both. Because my mother was so determined that I was going to see something else of the world, was going to see a world that was more beautiful than this down on its luck mill town where she grew up and where I grew up. She was determined to let me know that there were places in the world that were beautiful, places in the world where people did different kinds of work than my grandfather did in the skin mills. And I mean, she took me as a kid, and God, we had no money, but she managed somehow to scrape together, you know, 4 or 5 days, and she took me to Martha's Vineyard, where her ashes are scattered, and took me to Lake Placid. She was just determined that I would know something of the world beyond these Rust Belt mill towns. It was very important to her that I escape. And one of the sadnesses of her life, really, I think, was that having gotten me out of there, that I kept returning. She felt that it was her job to get me out, but she couldn't keep me out. And in that respect, I think she felt in some ways to be a failure. So in some ways, I'm more like Bobby, you know, the guy who became an artist. And for a long time, I didn't go back to Gloversville, just as he didn't go back to Thomaston. But in another sense, I'm also the kid who never left, because I haven't, I mean, even my Pennsylvania novel, Railton, my railroad town, that's just another iteration of Gloversville. So I don't know if that answers your question about what would your life have been like if you had never left. I was troubled for a long time, and I've told this story before, so if you've heard it before, I apologize, but one of the reasons that for a long time I didn't go back to my hometown, and I do go back an awful lot more now, but for a long time after my father died and my mother was becoming more ill, there were all sorts of reasons not to go back. But chief among them was that I always had this sense that there was another iteration of me, that I had gotten out, I'd gone west, I'd gone to the University of Arizona, I had found out that the life of the mind was important to me. But when I was at Arizona, I would come back in the summers, and I was old enough to drink then with my father. And after working road construction, long, hot days, sometimes 11-hour days working road construction with my old man in Albany, we would hit every roadhouse on the way back. And the sweating bottles of beer lined up and you know, just bar to bar to bar. And I could not drink with him. He could drink 3 beers to my one, and all of his friends could too. And I remember at the beginning of every summer, I would think, boy, I can't wait to get back to the university and get back to my life there. By the end of the summer, I was thinking, you know, this wouldn't be such a bad thing to do this kind of, to do this kind of honest, hard work. By the time I was finished in the summer, you know, my body was rock hard from doing difficult physical labor, as opposed to the slouch that I had become the other 9 months hanging out at the university library. And so there's always been, I've always had this sense that I came very, very close to just not going back one of those summers and just staying on, doing road construction, which means that there would have been probably another Rick Russo sitting on a bar stool, becoming increasingly angry, having a sense that whatever opportunity that I might have had, I had let pass. And the sense that I had of myself, of that self, of that other version of myself, was so unpleasant. Knowing how close that I had come to that made going home unpleasant. Whereas writing books about home, safe from in my university position, I was teaching at the time, was something that I could do without that sense of how narrowly I had escaped another destiny entirely. I think when we live a certain life and it ends or it progresses in a certain way, sometimes we have the sense, well, this was the life I was meant to lead, or this is the life that I chose for myself, this is the life that I've made for myself, and maybe it was the one. But I think if we look back honestly at our lives, they all hinge on certain small, pivotal decisions. They don't seem to us like life-changing decisions at the time. But I think there are multiple destinies for all of us, and the one that we're living is just one of them. And if you got a chance to do it all over again, I don't think you could do it the same way a second time. Even with the knowledge of what you've done already. Even if you could have that. And that was the challenge. See if you can do exactly what you did this time, a second time. And I'll bet you in an audience this size, there isn't anybody in this room that could live the same life twice.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, a broadcast of our live conversation with Richard Russo. Russo won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel Empire Falls, but may be best known for Nobody's Fool. Here's Paul Newman as Sully in the movie adaptation of Nobody's Fool. He's telling the now adult son that he left behind, played by Dylan Walsh, about his violent, alcoholic grandfather, Big Jim Sullivan.
You own this place?
City probably owns most of it now, back taxes. I grew up here. It was my father's house. As far as I'm concerned, it can rot. He was some piece of work, your grandfather.
That good, huh?
Yeah, he was good when he was sober, but then I don't think anybody ever saw him sober.
Sully and his son are back in Russo's new novel, Everybody's Fool. So is Roy Purdy, a minor character in the earlier book. Purdy reminded me of the disaffected, angry white men living in struggling factory towns that we so often hear about in the news. He's one of those left behind by the new economy, and one of few characters to be truly evil. He mutters to himself about how the government, the justice system, and his wife have done him wrong, and swears to get vengeance. I asked Richard Russo what life is like for men like Roy Purdy in towns like North Bath.
You're echoing something that one of my reviewers picked up on. I don't know if you might have seen it, but T.C. Boyle, who's a wonderful writer, had some very nice things to say about Everybody's Fool. And one of the things that he pointed out was that in this book, evil is much more present than it was in Nobody's Fool, which seemed to be a much lighter, more carefree book. And he wasn't suggesting that Everybody's Fool wasn't funny, but in this book there is a palpable sense of evil, I think. And you see it certainly in Roy Purdy, the wife batterer. But there's also the man who's in town under an alias, who is dealing in drugs, but also in poisonous reptiles. And there are a lot of snakes in this book, so if you're squeamish, that just to warn you. And of course, you can't put snakes in a book. You cannot evoke snakes without evoking the nature of evil and the Garden of Eden. And
if a snake appears in the third chapter, it's got to go off.
Yeah, And we also have a man named Kurt, who is the, not husband because they're not married, but they were together for a long time, who is the man who is so abused, psychologically abused, Alice, whom you referred to later. So yes, this book is much more steeped in evil, and part of the investigation is where in the world does this come from? And you get to come at it from a couple of, two or three different areas, or different perspectives of where this evil comes from. And I think that the reason that we do see evil as more present in this book has less to do with the fact that North Bath has changed or that its characters have changed, because actually Roy Purdy was in the earlier novel. Mm-hmm. He was a minor character, but he was up to no good then too. The difference was in that book he was so incompetent that his desire to harm people, you could get away with it and play it for laughs. By the time this book comes along, the simple truth is it's no longer funny. But that has less to do with Roy Purdy, I think, than it has to do with me. I'm 66 years old now. And Nobody's Fool was written 23 years ago. And so in this book, I think, and it kind of pains me a little bit to say this and just come out and say it, and to all of you good people, is that in the last 23 years, my observations, what I've observed in the world, haven't made me more cheerful in some ways. I've always thought of myself as an optimistic human being, and I still do. I still think of myself as, you know, promoting a kind of cautious optimism about ourselves and our humanity and our destiny as a people. But it seems, in the light of everything that's happened in the 23 years since Nobody's Fool was published, in those 23 years, Not only my life, but all of our lives have been assaulted, haven't they? With all sorts of evil. And I think this in this book, that all of that registers in some way.
As does, I think, class in many ways, the economic straits of a small town like that. And Cynthia asks, I've noticed your treatment of class, especially with the male characters. There seems to be a tenderer treatment of women. Elder women are treated with compassion. Can you say something about that?
Well, in this book, and really almost all of my books, the women are the sharper knives in the drawer. There's no question about that. A lot of what I see as praiseworthy, I have poured a lot of that into the character of Miss Burrell. Not only because she is such a smart and good woman, it's not that she's perfect. In fact, in treating Sully like a son, as she does in both of these books, she manages to treat her own son in a way that's probably damaging to him. So it's not like Miss Burrell is a saint, but she's a very smart woman and a very kind woman, and a woman who understands that there are no small lives, no small existences. And her heart goes out especially to these befuddled, lost men. And she writes in their margins, as a good teacher does for all of us, and they continue to write in our margins long after they're out of their classrooms. So there's Miss Burrell, but in this book, too, one of my favorite characters is the long-suffering Ruth, who at this point in her life is asking herself a question that she cannot answer, which is really, come on, what are men for? Because she just, because at this point, now that sex isn't as important to her as it once was, take that off the table, and really, what the f***? and she's contemplating in this book a clean world, and she imagines this world with this enormous shower, this shower head coming down, where she can wipe all the kind of male grime off of her body. And outside is the ocean. If the shower isn't strong enough, she can go outside and bathe in the ocean in a world of water and just get rid of her husband and get rid of Sully and get rid of Roy Purdy. It's this fantasy that she has of a world without not only men, but without male kind of soil and odor and... Yeah, this is what I love really most about storytelling. The way in which writers, and I think readers to a certain extent too, the wonderful way that we can, through imagination, just get over ourselves and join someone else's life imaginatively for a period of time. It allows me, through a character like Miss Burrell or through Ruth, to just imagine. You can just cross gender for a while. You can become older, you can become younger, you can become richer, you can become poorer. So you get to live more than one life. I, as a writer, one of the reasons that I love this so much is that I'm just not trapped in being Rick Russo all the time. I have an ability to become Sully, to become Miss Burrell. God help me to become Roy Purdy, because I have to understand him if I'm going to write about him. And it allows me to cheat life and cheat death. And I think, isn't that the same reason we read? And so we have that in common. I think this desire not to be trapped all the time in our own lives, our own concerns. We want to live as deeply and as richly in the lives of others as we do in our own lives. And so it's important for us to cross those important boundaries. And it's important to do, because there are so many people out there who don't want us to do it. These are people who want to undermine what I would like to think is an important part of all of our lives, which is moral imagination, the ability to see something else through somebody else's eyes.
I'm Virginia Prescott with a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, a conversation with the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. His latest novel is Everybody's Fool. Well, you said before that the character of Sully is sort of based on your dad, right?
Yeah.
He was a really entertaining guy, spent a lot of time in bars,
yeah.
Separated from your mom,
yeah.
World War II vet. I was wondering if you keep going back to North Bath because you want to hang out with your dad.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that to it.
Speaking of, you know, creating characters, you're creating
yes.
a life with
yeah,
him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One of the things, and I think this was very difficult for my mother, too. When your parents separate, and because my parents separated back in the 50s in a small town, that was very difficult for my mother to do. God knows she had plenty of reason. And they did separate, but I was the only kid that I knew in my neighborhood and in my school system that was coming from a family that was not intact. And what made matters even more perplexing, at least for a kid, was that I knew my father was in town. Sometimes when your parents split, one parent will go off someplace and he or she is not around. In my case, my father was in town, but I never saw him. So he was both there and not there. And that was the perfect crucible, I think, for yearning. And so when I was a kid, I was always wondering why he wasn't around. You know, and I had information about it. It wasn't that no one was talking to me. They were talking to me. They were giving me information. It was just that the information didn't quite add up in a way that made sense in a kind of deeply psychological way that would make sense to a kid. I knew the issues. I knew the information. But it still didn't make sense to me, which meant that I spent a lot of time as a kid yearning for somebody who wasn't there. And in some ways, underestimating and underappreciating someone who was, my mother who was doing the job of both parents during all of that time. I really only got to know my father after I was old enough to drink. And when we started doing road construction together. And not long after that, I married, and my wife and I began to have kids. And so my own life and his life became separate again. And it wasn't really that long after that. My daughters were still both very young when my father died. They have almost no memories of him. And so when my father got sick, really not long after I got to know him, what that left me was a sense of never getting my fill, you know? We became very close during those fairly brief years when we were together, but I always had a sense of just never having my fill of this man. And so I think anybody taking Psych 101 in any college in the country would understand that in a book like Everybody's Fool, really, I'm getting the chance to hang out with my dad for a while longer.
I love this question from someone in the audience. What is it about Sully that makes him a man I would overlook in real life, but maybe want to spend a night on satin sheets with? What makes him lovable? What makes him sexy besides the Paul Newman bit?
Yeah, that's the first thing I would ask is when she pictures Sully, is she picturing the Sully that I described, or is she picturing Paul Newman? Because I think those are two different questions.
Well, but that's what's great about the Paul Newman performance, because you forget he's so handsome because he does such a great job.
Yeah, well, maybe you did. I don't know if a lot of women did. Well, it's funny, you know, when my mother read Nobody's Fool, of course, she recognized her ex-husband right away. And one of her remarks was, it's funny, you know, I like him so much better on the page. And I think Sully in the book may have partially seduced even her. I don't know. But talking about the life of the imagination and our attempts to transcend gender and all of that and what makes the opposite sex attractive, you know, it's a challenge to do that. I think that the line that you read, actually, Virginia, has something to do with Sully's sexiness, is that he is so stubbornly independent. And when he looks at a woman, I think he is the kind of man who genuinely sees her. One of my favorite scenes in this book, and Sully and Ruth are no longer lovers in this book, but they're still best friends. And Ruth is the one who has demanded that they not be lovers anymore, and is resentful of Sully because he agreed. Right? But there is a section in which Ruth is thinking about Sully and comparing him to her husband, and noticing the way in which Sully, when he comes behind the counter in Hattie's Grill, Hattie's Lunch, when he comes behind the counter and is doing something there, he's always aware of where Ruth is. So if she needs to get behind him to get something out of the refrigerator and he's at the grill, he seems to have a second sense about where she is physically, so that when she needs to get by him, even if he has his head turned, he has the ability to pivot slightly so that she can get by. So they're never running into each other. They're never in each other's way. And there's a kind of physicality to that. It's a dance, in other words. And he has an awareness of her that I think her husband and really nobody else in her life has ever had of her, a physical awareness of where she is and what she needs. And we all know that dance is a metaphor, don't we? And so if their physical relationship, the dance that they do behind the counter, suggests that why they are good in bed together and why they have been good in bed together for all of these years, maybe there's something about Sully that makes women readers think that they would be seen by him, mm-hmm. or noticed by him.
If Everybody's Fool were to be made into a film, who could play Sully, asks Elizabeth.
Well, I think the trick to casting Sully and to casting Raymer in the movie, if there is a movie, there's no indication yet that there's going to be one. There are a couple of little mice nibbling around this big block of cheese, but I don't know if anything is going to come of those nibbles or not. But I think that what you would do if you wanted to cast Sully or if you wanted to cast Raymer, you would try really hard not to get an actor who physically reminds you of Paul Newman or of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Because the simple truth is there are no more Paul Newmans and there are no nor Philip Seymour Hoffmans. So rather than trying to replicate that, I think you would be much smarter to go in a completely different direction. Not long after I gave it to my editor, I gave it to Robert Benton, who was the director of Nobody's Fool, who has remained a dear friend. We've done three movies together, and we're always looking for things to do together. So I gave him a copy of Everybody's Fool, and he wrote back and said two things, after which I will not try to direct your movie anymore for you. He said, but the screenplay begins with Sully getting his diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And the second thing he said was, hold out for Clint Eastwood.
Ooh. Thank you, Richard Russo, so much for joining us today.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this special broadcast of Word of Mouth with Richard Russo, recorded live at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. Richard Russo also talked about his creative process with us for our 10-minute Writers Workshop podcast. You can hear a wide range of writers share their secrets and encouraging words by subscribing to the 10-minute Writers Workshop podcast on iTunes. Our broadcast sponsor this evening is Heinemann Publishing, and NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. Our recording and mixing engineer is Andrew Perella, and NHPR producer Molly Donahue, our digital producer Sarah Plourd. Thank you also to Angie Lane at NHPR, and special thanks to Michael Herman, Elizabeth Jewell, and to Gibson's Bookstore. And to Alex Casper, all of the genial ushers, and all the folks at the Capital Center for the Arts. And most of all, thank you for supporting your local public radio station, your local independent bookstore, and your local arts venue. Let's hear it.
Hear, hear.